I'm showing 9 o'clock, so we might as well begin because there's a lot to do. We're going to move, we're in the Holocaust, and hopefully we'll complete that and move into Avraham's journey to America. So let me begin. If you recall, the last thing I mentioned was that the Kletz Yeshiva had made its way to Vilna, including, I think this is the very last thing I said, with travel on Shabbos by the students because of the fear that they had to move in, leave Kletsk and make their way to Vilna. And it turned out, as I said, that to be a smart decision, because shortly following that, Vilna was given back and to Lithuania, and Lithuania was independent, and the other part where they were beforehand was part of the Soviet Union now. Now, the government asked the yeshivas to move out of the capital as it was becoming too crowded with all these non-residents. And it's not just the government. The government asked them to do this, but the Rosh Yeshiva also wanted to do that. You know, a big city is not always conducive to learning. And we'll see this again when we deal with the move to Lakewood. Actually, that reminds me, the picture I have on the left there, we mentioned Nissen Waxman last class, and we'll get back to him again today, I believe. There is a picture of Rabbi Nissen Waxman, who was the rabbi of Lakewood, and really the reason why the yeshiva moves to Lakewood. And he is together in that picture with Rav Herzog. So now let me get rid of the picture, but let's see. Tech support, I don't see how I can get rid of the picture to put Rav Aaron Cutler back on. So maybe you can do that for me. I don't see my link here. Here it is. Okay, I got it. I just had to move it. So now let me put Rav Aaron up again. You're supposed to see the sage. At this time, Kletsk, there was about 240, 250 students in Vilna, and they moved to a town called Yanova, which is about 30 kilometers from Kovno. Yanova, not to be confused with the Esrogim that come from Yanova, which that means is Yanova means Genoa in Italy. That's where they shipped from. But in the Jewish world, they've always been called the Esrogim from Yanova. Incidentally, those who come with us this summer to Greece, we will be going to Corfu, and we'll talk a good deal about the Esrogim from the Greek Isles, known as Esroge Corfu. But they moved to Yanova. Now, in Pecker's book, From Kletsk to Siberia, on page 36, he tells us that it was Rav Aaron's choice to move there, that he picked the place and it was his choice to move because in a big city there's all the distractions. The same thing if you look in the book I mentioned, Musrei Kletsk, page 497. However, we also have evidence that the yeshiva itself was ordered by the government itself. We have a letter from Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, who says, in addition to this, though, the Rosh Yeshiva themselves wanted to move. And it wasn't just the Kletsk Yeshiva, it was all the yeshivas. Let me give you some examples. Mir moved to Kaidan. Kamenetz moved to Rasein. Radin moved to Aishashuk. Aishashuk is the famous city which was the subject of Yaffa Eliach's. That's her town. Yaffa, it's not a city, the town. Yaffa Eliach's book. And if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, you see the pictures, that room there where they have all the pictures. You can see it online, I'm sure. That is from Aishashuk. Aishashuk also had a famous kollel before kollel was fashionable. Lomja went to Plungian. And the yeshiva, Rabbi Chanan, went to Troki. We mentioned this when we dealt with Rabbi Chanan. Troki is also the city of the famous Karait. There's the Hasidic yeshiva in Baranovich. Went to Tavrig. So everyone went to a different place. Now, the question was, is there a future, though, for the yeshiva Barachrim in Lithuania? During this time, there was a man named Zerach Varhaftig, who was also in Vilna. And Varhaftig would later become, he was a leader of Mizrahi. He would later become an important figure in the State of Israel. He signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was a minister of religion in much of the 60s into the 70s, a very important figure. In fact, I knew him because when I was writing my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I had contact with him. Varhaftig wrote a book. It was also translated into English called Refugee and Survivor. Varhaftig is more identified with Senpo Sugihara than anyone else. And when you think about the story we're going to talk about, more credit has to go to Varhaftig than anyone. During this time, Varhaftig was very interested in moving everyone who he could, and particularly the yeshiva students, out of Vilna and getting them out of Kovno, out of everywhere, and getting them. He came up with this plan. It's almost that you can read about it in the book. It's almost accidental how it came up, but he really is the brains behind it. There were some yeshiva students who were citizens of Holland, and they wanted to get out. So they, but how to get out? So they were. How are you supposed to get out of Lithuania? You have the Soviet Union on one side, you have Germany on the other side, and they came up with this idea that they can get a visa to Curacao. Now the problem is you didn't need a visa to Curacao. Once you got to Curacao, then it was determined that by the governor whether you'd be let in. However, they were able to convince the person who was running the embassy there that he should write on the passport that they have a visa, because if you have a visa to get into Curacao, that means that you have someplace that's going to take you. Then you could be able to leave the Soviet Union. So where you, the Soviet Union was said that the other people were worried, did they really mean it? But the Soviet Union would give you a transit visa. But then where to go? Well, that's where Varhaftig comes in, and they come up with this idea of through Japan, through Sugihara, that he could give them the transit visa. He could give them also a transit visa. So you have a transit visa through the Soviet Union. You get out with the Curacao visa. You have a transit visa through the Soviet Union and a transit visa through Japan. But there was never any intention to go to Curacao. And other than the Dutch students who were citizens of Holland, and Curacao was a Dutch property, there was never any intention to go to Curacao because they never would have been allowed to go to Curacao to begin with. And the idea was once they get to Japan, even though the transit visas in Japan were only for 7 days, they would figure something out. And they did figure something out because it was extended. And then they moved to Shanghai. But this was something, and once this was set in place, and anyone could do this, Sugihara began going around and telling all that he was a particular, as a religious Jew whose father was a great Torah scholar who also makes it out of Europe and makes his way from Warsaw and makes his way to the land of Israel. Varhaftig, he was also a Talmud Chacham, he published a few Sfarim. He was very interested in getting the yeshiva students out. Shortly before his death, he died at age 96. He publishes an article. I can send a copy if anyone wants. He said the title of the article is "Halachti mi'adam le'adam." I went from person to person, with tzibur tzibur, and from community to community, and said, "Save yourself." And he tells the story of going to Rav Aaron Cutler. Now, before I tell the story, I think we have to. Let me just. I have to repeat what I said last class, and I think it's important. After hearing what I'm going to tell you, and it's not just about Rav Aaron, it's about the Brisker Rav, it's about Rav Chaim Moser. A lot of the people like to blame the rabbis, and I really think it's unfair. They blame the Satmar Rebbe, etc. At the end of the day, people made a choice. They chose to listen to certain rabbis. The rabbis made decisions, which in retrospect turned out to be mistaken, and I don't see how people can put they, because they chose to listen to a rabbi, how they then can blame the rabbi when it was their choice. They made the choice at the end of the day whether they thought the rabbi's opinion was going to be useful in this circumstance. Now, with the Satmar Rebbe, things are more complicated because he was an anti-Zionist. And he was constantly urging the people. So you could say that his anti-Zionism blinded him to the reality. Okay, so maybe you can make a case there. But that's not the case with the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, who had no problem with settling in the land of Israel. Varhaftig goes to Rav Aaron. And let me also say that until the end of his life, I'll read you what he says. He was angry with Rav Aaron. He goes to Rav Aaron and speaks to him about bringing the yeshiva students to Israel, because at this time they could get them certificates. There was always an issue of getting them certificates, because the certificates to enter Palestine were limited. And there were people who didn't want yeshiva students to come in. In fact, there were some influential people on the Jewish agency who said that the yeshiva students should only be permitted to enter if they agreed to go to work, because the land of Israel doesn't need to have people just sit, more people just sitting and studying. Verhofstadt discusses this in his book. But once all the Zionist leaders were gone, then Verhofstadt was given permission to bring the yeshiva students. He went to Rav Aaron, and Rav Aaron said, "I don't want these immigration certificates. They're no better. They're no different than Nier Asher Yatzar." He called them toilet paper. They're just like, they're useless as toilet paper. And he wasn't the only person to use this expression. Rabbi Hirschsprung, in his memoir, says that this was a common joke, because all these people were saying, when they had this idea of, you know, go to Japan. Can you imagine Hasidic people and yeshivish people to make their way to Japan? That's like it's like a different planet. They were mocking these visas and calling them, you know, not instead of paper visa paper, toilet, Asher Yatzar paper, toilet paper. And that was the standard position. That was the position of the rabbis, with limited exceptions. In fact, the Mir Yeshiva is the only one that the whole yeshiva went and took it. And this was against the Das Torah of the great rabbis. Rav Hirschsprung recalls that he opened up this yeshiva, Chachmei Lublin. He comes from where the Hasidic background, and he had a chassid with him, and they went to Rav Chaim Ozer, and Rav Chaim Ozer Brzezinski says that since we don't know what's going to be, Shev al tase, it's better to just remain in Vilna. And fortunately, they didn't listen to him, and Rav Hirschsprung mentions that he was accompanied by a chassid who said, well, if Rav Chaim Ozer says to stay in Vilna, then we should do the exact opposite. Because, you know, Rav Chaim Ozer is a misnagid, and he's a chassid. Now, in this article, Varhaftig, and he has a more negative feeling to Rav Aaron than the other Rosh Yeshiva, because he feels that Rav Aaron was much stronger in his opposition. He also says, later on, by the way, it's Rav Aaron does make his way to Japan, and he gets there. Varhaftig was able to get him a transit visa to go through Japan. So it's due to Varhaftig that he ends up making it to the United States. But he wouldn't take them for the yeshiva. And Varhaftig's judgment was, and I'm reading here, that and he isn't just not just about Rav Aaron, but about all the Rosh Yeshiva. They wanted to, him ratzu latzil at yeshivot. They wanted to save the yeshivas, and I wanted to save the b'nei yeshivos. And their assumption was that Lithuania can remain the way it is and will be safe here. And Varhaftig explains that he never figured that a small country like Lithuania, without any army, without any history, is going to be able to remain independent. He says that even to this day, Varhaftig, this is from, he dies in 2002, this is from 2001, this article, he is angry at the position of the Rosh Yeshiva, that caused Rabim Mitalmidehem, that caused many of their students to remain and to lose the possibility of Hatzala. Varhaftig says, among many, not just among the Rosh Yeshiva, there was a complete belief that this was Lithuania, that Lithuania was the most safe place in Europe because it's independent and neutral. And then he says, Ani koesah Rav Kotler, Sha'amar Talmidim Shelo, Al Tichu et Tanayirot Shel Varhaftig. He says, and this is years, decades after the Holocaust, so 60 years later, he says, I am angry at Rav Aaron because Rav Aaron told his students not to listen to me and take the Sugihara documents. Mr. Zalman Meltzer had also arranged for Rivaron to be sent to be have a certificate to enter Eretz Yisrael. And with that document, he could have also left through Japan. In addition, certificates were also sent in the same batch to the Briskarov. If I'm not mistaken, the Briskarov made his way through Turkey. That's how he got there. He went through the Soviet Union through Turkey on the boat. Also, Rav Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, the Mir Yosh Yeshiva, and the Rebbes of Amshinov and Mojits. I have to check it. I'm not sure if the Mojitzer actually ends up making it out alive, but the Amshinover does. However, Rav Aaron refuses to leave his students. So for all the criticism of our Haftig, it's not like we're not dealing with a situation like the Satmarov or the Belzer Rebbe, where they leave and they leave everyone. Rav Aaron remains with his students. So he didn't see something that they... taking a chance for himself. He put his own life in danger by remaining with his students. He writes to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, and this letter, you can see it in Sarovsky on page 301, as well as other places. He says to him, as long as there's no possibility to bring the entire yeshiva to Eretz Yisrael, I can't go myself. From our Haftik's perspective, forget about Eretz Yisrael. You could bring the entire yeshiva to Japan. But Rav Aaron didn't think that there was a necessity to go to Japan. If you could get the entire yeshiva into the land of Israel, then they would go. But they're not leaving Lithuania to go to Japan. And he says, as long as we can't do it, the whole yeshiva, I cannot go myself. And then he says, see, Rav Aaron was urging him to come himself. First of all, it's Rav Aaron's daughter and grandchildren, but it's also not Rav Aaron, it's Rav Isser Zalman's daughter and grandchildren, but he also loved Rav Aaron, and he's telling Rav Aaron, leave the yeshiva students. Moshe asked, didn't the option ever go to Shanghai? He did. He got he was there the whole time. He left Rav Aaron didn't go to Shanghai. He ended up going to America, as I'll explain, but the option over remained. Rav Isser Zalman told Rav Aaron to leave the yeshiva students and come to Eretz Yisrael. And Aaron writes to him, if you were here, you would also agree with me that this matter is impossible. And that is to leave the students. And he says, that you're worried that we're not going to be able to extend the certificate. He says, if worse comes to worse, I'll go with the certificates of the yeshiva. And if chas v'shalom, we can't all get it, I'll have to stay here. And then he continues in this letter to talk about other people who it's important to save. He had this orphan girl who he raised in his house, and the mashgiach of the yeshiva. So he's willing to save some individuals, but not himself. Like the captain goes down with the ship. We also have in the book Musrei Kletz, which I have here somewhere, on page 497, we have a letter that Rav Aaron writes to the Jewish Agency, in which he explains, this is from Adar of Okay, I'm sorry that we were lost for a second, but I'm back. Adar of 1940, Rav Aaron writes to the Jewish Agency saying that we're 240 people, students, we want to go to Israel. Our whole desire is to go on Aliyah, just like all other Jews want to. So asking for a certificate. The Jewish Agency was only given limited numbers of certificates. So, of course, in the Orthodox press, in the Haredi press in particular, the Jewish Agency is criticized. The Jewish Agency distributed them. They gave to Mizrahi. They gave some to Aguda. They gave most to the Zionists. Basically, the people who were involved in Jewish Agency they got the most certificates. The Jewish Agency took care of themselves, just like later we'll see Vahrehan Hatzalah took care of its people. That's just the way it worked. And I think it's probably a little unfair to criticize the Jewish Agency for not giving certificates for the yeshiva students. It's not like the Jewish Agency was not doing anything with these certificates and destroying them and saying, we don't want yeshiva students. They only had a limited number of certificates. They gave it to Zionist people. All the leading Zionist figures, including Mizrahi figures, they all got out. They got Jewish Agency certificates. I don't know what's happening with the losing it. If there's a problem, I'm going to have to switch to a different computer if it does it again. Getting back to my point, it's only natural that you would expect the Jewish Agency, which is a Zionist organization, if given the choice to save some people, to save their own. I mean, it would be nice maybe if they also said the yeshiva students, they're the future of the Jewish people, save them. But I don't think you can expect from Zionists, especially irreligious Zionists, to prefer yeshiva students over their own people. And just like you can't expect the yeshiva students and the Agudas Rabbanim to take Zionists over rabbis. That's just the reality. It was a terrible situation where there was only limited numbers of possibility of visas. And also understand that at this time, it's not like people are being killed in Lithuania. So, not that the British was so good when it came to visas, but they couldn't go to the British and say that the people in Lithuania are being killed. Even in Poland, they are put in ghettos, and the people in Poland couldn't get out. They didn't have really the, they couldn't apply any humanitarian pressure of the sort that maybe would move the British, who really did not want to let any Jews into the land of Israel, other than the small group. Heschel tells us he's on the board of the Jewish Agency. Yes, and we spoke a little bit about the Jewish Agency last week, and I thought you were going. You've also been very involved in the Federation, and I thought maybe you were going to chime in when I said that when it comes to the percentage of money raised versus how much goes to overhead, our federations are really the best. We have another letter, which is Sarosky Prince on page 29. No, actually, it doesn't. Is it a letter? Hold on, let me see. Oh yeah, on page 298, note 4, we have a letter from Rav Chaim Ozer. To Revisor Zalman, to, no, to Mayor Berlin, is it Mayor Berlin, in which he says, I'm not going to argue with you. You think that all the Russia yeshiva should go to Israel, v'es ha-talmidim la'azov b'mkomam, and leave the students. And then Rav Chaim Ozer says, but the student, the Russia yeshiva, their whole existence depends on the students, and the students depend on the Rosh Yeshiva. So here we see even Mayor Bar-Ilan was saying that we can get certificates for the Rosh Yeshiva. You Rosh Yeshiva should come to Israel. You could start up yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. We can try to get the other people in later, but don't give up the possibility of coming because then these certificates, they're going to have to be given to other people. If we have certificates for you, Rosh Yeshiva, because you're important people, let's take them. It's a tough decision. Finally, there's another letter I found in also in the book Musrei Kletzk from Rav Aharon to Rav Eliezer Silver. This is in Cincinnati. This is page 500, in which he says that my father-in-law is urging me to leave, but I can't leave without the yeshiva. The only way I'll leave is if my health requires me to leave. So that's the situation. Interestingly enough, on the same in the same letter, we see that the Agudas Rabbanim in America was working on a plan. He calls it a Rayon Kadosh, a holy plan, to bring the yeshivas all the great yeshivas I just mentioned to America. They probably could have brought one or two. I don't think they would have been given permission to bring all the yeshivas. They had the same visa restrictions in America. Rav Arono says that you have to do this to bring all the yeshivas together. And he says you have to get people involved. Anshei Shem Masa, Kamal Lehman, the New York governor. I don't know if he's a governor at that time, but non-Jews involved. In June 1940, the Soviets move into Lithuania, and Rav Aaron is now in the Iron Curtain. Obviously, there's no future for the Kletz Yeshiva or any of the other yeshivas, and he had to leave. Fortunately, people in America had arranged 400 visas for rabbis and leaders of communities. We'll see Heschel Raskus mentioned last class, Irving Bunim. Irving Bunim, who I have his the book by his son right here, A Fire in His Soul, is maybe the most influential layperson in Vod Hatzalah. In the introduction, in the foreword to the book, Professor David Wyman, who wrote a book on Jews in the war, he says, it's no exaggeration to say that Vod Hatzalah revolved around Irving Bunim. And once Rav Aaron comes to America, he and Irving Bunim become very close. So we'll get to that. But the Vod Hatzalah, the Orthodox rabbis, I don't know if it was the Vod Hatzalah or the Orthodox rabbis of the Agudas Rabbanim, they arrange for 400 visas for yeshiva students and leaders. And Rav Aaron was given a visa for himself, his wife, his daughter, and this orphan girl I mentioned he raised. Well, what about the rest of the yeshiva? Earlier, as we mentioned, he refused to leave without the yeshiva. However, now he realizes that everyone, I'm going to try a different computer now. Let me just, I have a different computer on my desk, which we're having trouble with this new system, which is supposed to be better. Let me just try if I can get on this other computer, and then I'll switch to that, and hopefully this will just take a minute here. If not, for next class, I have another computer upstairs. And the problem is I tried to log on to this other computer before, and I was having problems. But give me a minute here while I load it up. While I'm doing that, I'll talk for a second. Hold on. See if I can get us up here. I think it's working. Let's see. See if we can. In the meantime, I'll speak while it's working on that. He realizes that he can't save anyone, the yeshiva students. And if he. I think it's going to open. And if he stays there, no one's going to be helped. Why does he choose to? He still has the certificate to go to Eretz Yisrael. He chooses to go to America because in America, he feels he'll have a better chance of helping his students, the politicians in America. Things will be a lot better. Let's see. I think I'm up here now. No. Not working. So, it's coming on.
It's coming on.
Okay.
Okay.
What I want to do is I'm going to close out. Okay, now you can all hear me? Let me know if you can hear me. Okay, good. So, you know, they try to improve these systems, and rather than improving it, it makes it worse. I don't know if you see this. I see a green thing right around my face. But okay, we'll make do. He decides to go to America, but he sends his son, Rav Schneur, to Eretz Yisrael. Now, what led Rav Aharon to leave? At the time he did, Pecker, on page 48, tells a story of how Rav Aharon is summoned to the NKVD, which is the predecessor of the KGB. And then he tells a story how Rav Aharon even did the lottery of the Vilna Gaon, the Goro Hagra. And the verse that came up was in Shemos, where it says, these are Aaron and Moses, whom God said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt. So that obviously means it's time to leave. Well, how? Okay, so he has a visa to get to America, entry visa. How to get to America? Again, the only way, I shouldn't say the only way, because as I said, the Brisker Rav went through Turkey, but the easiest way and the most secure way, it seems, is through the Soviet Union. This was a long journey, and if you look in the history of the Mir Yeshiva published by them, they see this as a miracle that the Soviet Union actually agreed. Yes, they got money. So it seems to be it was just about money. They got hard currency, but they allowed them to travel all the way across the Soviet Union to the very eastern part, and then they transferred to Japan. So the only way he would take that trip through Siberia, if any of you went to YU, you might remember Rabbi Gulevsky. I've mentioned him in the past, the grandson of Simcha Zelig Grieger of Brisk. He was one of the people from Kletsk who also got a visa and who traveled together with Rav Aharon. But he made it, so he, in February 1941, Rav Aharon made his way from Kovno. That's where Sugihara was, by the way, in Kovno, by train to travel across the entire Soviet Union. This train also had another 100 students from different yeshivos that was with him. He was only in Japan a short while. Unlike the rest of them who stayed in Japan, they were able to get an extension of their visa. There was actually a professor of Hebrew, a great lover of the Jewish people who lived in Japan, and he helped him get an extension, and then they were moved to Shanghai, but we're not dealing with that story. We're dealing with Rav Aharon. So let me just note that he stayed in Japan just a short while. He wasn't there for any of the disputes about, you know, what day to celebrate Yom Kippur, Shabbos, I don't know what he did there. And then he goes to the United States. While he's in Japan, for the short time he's there, however, he does what he can, writing and making contacts to help the students. He reaches America, Erev Pesach 1941, and I found a report on his arrival in Hapardes. Hapardes, year 15, issue number 2, page 2. This is the article on Thursday, Erev Pesach. The great Rav Aharon Cutler arrived in San Francisco. There was a great Kabbalas Panim welcoming for him in San Francisco with the important lay people of the town that waited for him on the shore. They accompanied him to the house where he would remain while he's there. Even though he is a weak man after such a long journey, on Chol HaMoed, he continued. He just remained in San Francisco for Yontif. On Chol HaMoed, he continued to New York so he could immediately be involved in Hatzalah rescue for the yeshivot. Matarat HaGaon, the purpose of Rav Aharon, they say, of being in the United States, is to save the Kletsk yeshiva and the other yeshiva from a very difficult circumstance. The Gaon, Rav Aharon, spent the final days of the holiday in Chicago, and then he went on to Cincinnati. And while there, he spoke about the conditions of the yeshivas. And he says this, he says when he was in Chicago, he stayed at the house of his mechutan, Rav Ephraim Epstein. Ephraim Epstein, the leading rabbi in Chicago, how is he his mechutan? Rav Ephraim Epstein is the brother of Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Sobotka of Chevron. And
Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein is the brother-in-law of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who's the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler. So in that sense, you can call them mechutanim, even though it's quite far removed. Rav Ephraim Epstein, his son was one of the American students who was learning in the Chevron Yeshiva, who was killed in 1929. And then it says, on Monday, the Rav Aaron arrives in New York at the train station. There's a big Kabbalah Sponim for him from Agudas Rabbanim and from other rabbis. Zechus Gadol, it's a great zechus for America that this Gaon is in our country. He's one of the greatest of the Russia yeshiva, and he was exiled to Vilna, which is with his yeshiva. Now pay attention to what I'm going to tell you now, where Varon says. He brought from Lithuania Yediot Mesamchot, happy tidings, that all the yeshivas are existing and they're learning there in Asmada Gedola with great vigor. Both the students and their rebbes in every yeshiva, and he goes through the names, Kletsk, Radin, Tel, Slobodka, Kamenetz, Lutsk, Bialystok, Lomja, Baranovitz, Beis Yosef, that's Novardik, Grodna, Ponovezh, Pinsk, and Oz. He says the sound of Torah is heard day and night. They write their Chidushei Torah. Ein Pachad Neged Einei B'nei Torah. He says they're starving. They need food. However, and people need, we need to support them, but they're not afraid. He doesn't, Rav Aaron in his speech is not sounding worried, not saying it's a problem. Our time is, you know, it's an emergency. He realizes you have to get them out. That's why he comes, but he doesn't see it as, in other words, he's not saying that we have to immediately remove them. Instead, he speaks about how they're able to learn. Very strange, considering what's going to happen in a couple weeks. One more thing, it's what's not reported in this Harpardes piece is that together on the boat with Rav Aaron from Japan to San Francisco was Rav Mendel Zaks. Rav Mendel Zaks was the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, Rosh Yeshiva of the Radin Yeshiva, and he also comes to America for the same reasons as Rav Aaron, to try to assist in bringing the Yeshiva students. This Rav Mendel Zaks ends up working at YU, and the rest of his time in America, oh, he's a rabbi of a shul on the Upper West Side, and he works at Yeshiva Shribitz Elchanan. His job, they call it the bochein. His job was to test the students, things like that. So, and that's the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law. Despite what the Hapardes reports about Rav Aaron saying that the situation of the yeshivas, other than the fact that they need money, but it's a solid situation, shortly after Pesach, which is only a couple of weeks after the Hapardes report, Rav Aaron tells the people, and we have it again reported, that in America, he tells the people in America that the destruction taking place in Europe was worse than anything since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So either something radically changed in these few weeks, or I think more likely that the reporter, the person who reported this for Hapardes, he heard Rav Aaron talk about how great the learning was, and he himself put the spin on it. Well, then, you know, everything else is fine. Because that wasn't Rav Aaron's perspective. He wouldn't have left the students if he thought everything was fine. Now, at this time, spring 1941, the situation is very difficult because there are no more Sugi Hara visas. He gives the visas from June 1940, when the Soviets occupy Vilna, until September 1940. It's a very short period. While the Soviets allow Jews to leave Lithuania until May 1941, you could only leave if you had a visa from another country. And it wasn't so simple to get that. If you had a visa from another country, if you had a visa from America, well, then the Soviet Union would let you leave. And you could go as, you know, well, you need a transit visa from Japan as well. But Japan, you can get it. You could have gotten a transit visa when Sugihara was there. Fortunately, Var Haftik had them. You could have, it's possible you could have gotten also in Moscow at the embassy. You could have traveled to Moscow, and if you had American the American entry visa you could have gotten it. The thing about the Sugihara visas was the whole thing was a fraud. Sugihara knew it was a fraud. The whole idea was just to give them these visas to enable them, once they reached the end of the Soviet Union, to be able to enter Japan. Everyone knew that these Dutch visas were fraudulent. So Sugihara himself was involved in Hatsala. But once Sugihara is gone, if you could get an entry visa somewhere else, then you could go to Moscow or elsewhere and you can get in. But it was very difficult to get these entry visas. Now, the Germans invade the Soviet Union on June 22nd, 1941. They enter Vilna on June 26th. So all the Jews in Vilna, really all the Jews in Lithuania, are then trapped. And that's really it for the yeshiva students, not just the Kletz yeshiva. All the yeshiva students who had made their way to Lithuania, once the Soviet Union, once the Germans move in, that's it. Many yeshiva students had been able to make their way deep into, in fact, Pecker, in his book, discusses this. He survived the war in Siberia, and Varadzala was sending material to Jews in Siberia. There were a number of yeshiva students who made it there, but again, these were the smart ones or the lucky ones who decided to leave. Once the Germans take over Lithuania, there is no exit. No one can get out. So really, at that point, it doesn't really matter if there's no America does, is giving visas or not giving visas, or the British are not letting anyone in, because no one's getting out. One historian makes this point very strongly, calling it the myth of rescue, because he argues that really all the rescue, his name is Rubinstein, all the rescue possibilities were before. Not once the Germans take over. It's a little bit of a faulty argument, because there still was Hungary and other parts in which the Jews were not under the German control. But when it comes to Lithuania, after June 1941, no one can get out; they're trapped. Ravaron arrives in New York and he sets up an office designed to rescue the Kletz Yeshiva students, particularly them, and then he's involved in Varatzala for all the yeshiva students. Sarosky, in his book on page 355, quotes a survivor from Shanghai, who says that Rav Aaron was like our father when we were in Shanghai. He was the head of Varatzala. He was our Malach, they call him, and he was. He helped raise a lot of money. He did more than that. We'll see what he did in Washington, D.C. He sent them money, and yet there still is controversy about this. There's a Rabbi Weissmandel. What I'm going to tell you now is not in print, as far as I know. I mean, you'll see it in various comments on blogs, and it's part of the Oral Torah. It's hard to pin down exactly what the facts are about it, other than the general story. I'll give you the story that's told. I don't know if it's true, but there's no question that there was tension between Rabbi Weissmandel and Rav Aaron. Rabbi Weissmandel was in Slovakia, and he was head of this group that was in years after, in 43, 44. He survives the war, and they had, it's called the Working Group. It was, and he was the one who was very much involved with alerting the World Jewish Congress to what was going on, and focusing on the need for money for rescue. Supposedly, Rabbi Weissmandel was so angry at Rav Aaron and the Varatzala that he actually had a physical confrontation with him, and physically pushed him down, arguing that by sending money, by Varatzala sending money for yeshiva students, they were killing people in Slovakia, because this money could have been used to save lives. Supposedly, again, I don't know if this is true, supposedly Rabbi Weissmandel called this. Have you ever seen this document here on the left coming up? This is the Talmud that was printed in Shanghai. First volume was printed in 1942. Supposedly, Rabbi Weissmandel, who was of the Hungarian, you know, Satmar type variety, supposedly he called this Talmud a Blut Talmud, that is a blood Talmud, that is the money that was spent from the Vat Hatzalah to print this Talmud. That money could have been used to rescue Jews in Slovakia, because it was a simple equation in Slovakia. If you have enough, for every certain amount of dollars, the Nazis will, you can rescue a Jew. So it was just however much money you have, that's how much you can save. I don't know whether this is correct, though, this story about the blood Talmud, because the Vat Hatzalah printed a Talmud, but the Talmud they printed was in Germany after the war. Brandeis University has an exemplar of that entire Talmud. I have never seen evidence that the Vat Hatzalah was involved in the printing of the Talmud you're looking at. And if criticism is warranted, and I'm not sure if it's warranted, are you supposed to say that the yeshiva students living in Shanghai are not supposed to have a Talmud? And it's not just a Talmud, they printed other Sfarim. Then it should be directed against the Mir Yeshiva. It was the Mir Yeshiva that printed the Talmud. At first I thought that Rav Aharon had no idea that this Talmud was printed. The reason I thought that is because in Irving Bunim's book on page 357, it prints an article from Hapardes in English translation, which it says as follows. Rav Aharon writes this and is saying this in Hapardes. In spite of the enormous difficulties that confront them, that is the Mir Yeshiva students daily, they managed, much to our surprise and delight, to publish copies of the Talmud and even the Navalei of the Rashba. This fact attests to their indomitable spirit of unswerving devotion to Torah. So here you see that Rav Aharon didn't even know they were publishing the Talmud. But then I looked at the actual Hapardes article, and it doesn't say that at all. All it says is that Higia Elena Basara Tova, we received the good news that they printed the Talmud. It doesn't say that they were surprised. But I don't know if Vat Hatzalah gave them money with the intention of printing the Talmud. So if you're Rabbi Weissmandel, you could argue that the fact that the Mir Yeshiva had enough money to print the Talmud shows that they didn't need all the money that they were getting. The Vat Hatzalah could have sent them less money and sent the rest to Slovakia. This is one of the disputes that continues to rage today about the Vat Hatzalah. And I don't have an answer to this. I mean, is Vat Hatzalah not supposed to try to recreate the yeshiva? And you could say that if someone in Shanghai who buys his jacket is falling apart. If he buys a new jacket, well, that could save lives also. So he shouldn't have a new jacket. He should walk around with no jacket. I don't know where you draw the line at this. This is not the only disputes. There's another big controversy that to this day still is very strong. The dispute with Rabbi Weissmandel, that's just known by limited people. But what I'm going to tell you now, all you got to do is Google it. Just Google and in English or in Hebrew, Rav Aharon Cutler, Chabad, Shanghai, and you will see that to this day, there are very negative feelings from Chabad to Rav Aharon Cutler. Even though what I'm going to show you now, it has nothing to do with Rav Aharon Cutler, it's Rav Kalmanovitz. But they associate Rav Aharon Cutler with this because he was the head of the Vat Hatzalah. So even if he had nothing to do with what I'm going to tell you, they still blame him. Even Rav Aharon Cutler, who more than anyone else was involved day in and day out with saving lives in Vat Hatzalah, and because of that, he remains as a hero in Jewish history for everything he did. He does not remain as a hero for Chabad. On the contrary, for Chabad, he's not one of the good guys. They don't think he's one of the good guys in any event because of after the war, his relationship to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rav Aharon was very, very anti-Chabad. And when I say if you read Chabad the way they write about him, they don't even refer to him often as rabbi. He's just Cutler. That's there's an issue. Well, what's this all about? I'm holding a document in my hand, which I can send to anyone. First appears about 7-8 years ago, but it was rumored to exist. It's from 1946 Shanghai. And Shanghai had a Chabad rabbi there, Ashkenazi. This is a letter written from the Chabad students who were in Shanghai. She was Tomchei Tamimi in Shanghai, to Rav Shamaria Gurari. This is the son-in-law of the Rayatz, so the Friedrich Rebbe, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, Barry Gurari's father, the one who many people thought would become Rebbe. And it tells about what happened during the war years. And in particular, Vat Hatzalah. It tells that in Kislev of December of 1942, there was a change in the care packages that were sent for the B'nai Torah. That is, the Vat Hatzalah would send care packages for the yeshiva students. It says that that from now on, everything would be sent to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz of the Mir Yeshiva, and he would distribute them in accordance to how many students they had. But then it continues that what happened is that in Shavat, later, a couple months later, money came in from the Vat Hatzalah, and this time the telegram came. It was signed by Rabbi Kalmanovitz, who was from the Mir, who was in New York, assisting in Vat Hatzalah, and it was sent to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and it says that they should be distributed, all the care packages should be distributed to the B'nai Torah, Levad Chabad, but not Chabad. Any Chabadnik who knows the history knows this very well, that when the money came from the Vat Hatzalah, it was only for the yeshiva students, not for Chabad. Now, I don't know what Rav Kalmanovitz's rationale was. Maybe his rationale was that Chabad, it's not that when we speak of the yeshivas, the Vat Hatzalah is supposed to be for the yeshivas, and Chabad, it's not the Lithuanian yeshiva, it's a Chabad yeshiva, they have their own backers. Whatever it is, they didn't get. Then, okay, so in Shavat, they do not get the care package. Then, two other times following that, care packages were sent, where it also says, this should go to all the B'nai Torah. But it didn't say on this telegram, with the exception of Chabad. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's argument was, well, it must be the same thing as the last time, namely that this should be distributed to the yeshiva students other than Chabad. But the Chabadnik came argue that no, since it only said for the B'nai Torah and it didn't specify not for Chabad, that they too should get it. And it says that L'koshi gado b'tircha yatera, the Bizionos Mamash, he says that with great difficulty, and they had to suffer, you know, terrible put downs and everything. But Rav Chaim Shmulevitz agreed to give it to them, and then it says they did not give any support either for the Rebbe of Amshinov and his family. Why? They claim that he's not a yeshiva man. He's not a yeshiva student. And then it says, okay, so then why is the Rav Aaron Cutler have anything to do with this? They're clear here that, I want to read you the exact thing, that it doesn't come from Rav Aaron Cutler at all. This comes from Rav Kalmanovitz. So I can't find the exact line here, I can't, it might not be even in this, I don't see it now, here it is, yes, sorry. Hanusach ba telegram of Kalmanovitz Rav Chaim was to give to all the B'nai Torah with the exception of Chabad. I guess from Chabad's perspective, if it comes from the Vat Hatzalah, and the Vat Hatzalah is headed by Rav Aaron Cutler or Kalmanovitz and the other ones, that he too has to take the blame for it. But this document remains a very a sore point of contention. There's even a report that there was a Din Torah after the war between Chabad and Rav Aaron Cutler, but I've never been able to find any documentation about this. And I think we should assume that, finances are limited. If they made that decision, that they had a good reason for determining who should get it and who not. Maybe they assumed that there was Chabadnikim in America. You had the Rebbe in America. The Chabad was sending also stuff over there. So maybe the consideration was, well, Chabad is sending for Chabad. And as most of us know, Chabad usually looks out for Chabad first above anyone else. And then they look out for everyone else. But if it's between Chabad and others, Chabad will go first. So if the Vada Yeshivas is assuming, and not just assuming, knowing that Chabad is raising for Chabad, I don't know if it's so terrible that they decide that, then we're only going to send our money to the yeshiva students, Lithuanian yeshiva students. But I don't know how much was getting in from Chabad for them. Okay, I see it's already 9:57. What we still need to do is we're going to pick up immediately next class with Rav Aaron Cutler in America, his Vad Hatzalah activities in Washington. This book with Irving Bunim about Irving Bunim become very important. And then we have to move into the establishment of the yeshiva, because the Lakewood Yeshiva, it's not just Vad Hatzalah. His mind is also on Torah. And this is also the era, first, of the establishment of the Kollel, which then moves into the great yeshiva in Lakewood. And the class after that, maybe we'll have to ask Harry Kelman to even do another class on Rav Aaron in America and what he achieves. But I'm happy to take now some questions and some comments. It's a difficult period, obviously, and I think it's really wrong for anyone to second guess. I understand the Chabadnikim, their perspective, but from everyone else, to second guess decisions made in the war, who can make these judgments? And who's to say what the correct decision was? It's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback and to, and I understand Varhaftig. Varhaftig, and he was with Rav Aaron, and he was very upset because he was arguing the point and Rav Aaron didn't listen to him. So I understand. Let me read you something else, though, that he mentions about Rav Aaron, which from Varhaftig's perspective showed that Rav Aaron didn't learn anything from what they went through. Varhaftig also makes his way to America. He becomes an American citizen. But in 1947, he decides it's time for him to go back to go to Eretz Yisrael. Before leaving New York, I call upon the late Rabbi Aaron Cutler in order to receive his blessing. Rabbi Cutler openly disapproved of my departure for Eretz Yisrael, of my dragging four small children to a country in peril. I attempted to explain to him that I simply had to be among those who would usher in the revival of Jewish statehood. Rabbi Cutler questioned whether I really believed in the impending establishment of the Jewish state. I most certainly did, and since the end of the war, we had readied ourselves for the move. So here you see, even in 1947, Rav Aaron does not think it's a smart idea to go to Israel. And from Varhaftig's perspective, and the reason I think that he's so much more negative to Rav Aaron than he is to the other Rosh Yeshiva and to Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, who said the exact same thing, is because Varhaftig saw the anti-Zionism in Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron had an anti-Zionism, which I think that's the reason why Varhaftig feels more negative to him, and he singles him out for criticism. And that's why I think he includes that other story. But at the end of the day, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, who was had no issues, was a supporter of settlement in the land of Israel, and many others, they also had the judgment that best to remain in Lithuania, see what the future brings, rather than going to Japan. And let's not forget that there was a fear that these people were Polish citizens, and they're going to get on a train, and they're going to go through the Soviet Union. There was a great worry that this was some sort of trap, and they would be pulled off the train. They want to leave the Soviet Union. That's an act of treason. And they're from Poland, but now many of them are now, Poland was controlled, a part of it, by the Soviet Union, and they could be regarded as traitors for wanting to leave the Soviet Union. I mean, so it was a real chance, and even a life and death chance, to get on the train. The idea that the Soviets would let you actually travel 2 weeks through the Soviet Union to leave when they don't allow anyone to leave. So I think everyone should have that in mind. And it's very easy, as I said, to be a Monday morning quarterback. Okay, let me take a few questions. Moshe asks, where was Rav Isher Zalman at this time? Rav Isher Zalman was the head of the Etz Chaim Yeshiva. He had already gone in the 1930s. Remember, we mentioned that he left Slutsk and joins Rav Aharon in Kletsk, but he's not the Rosh Yeshiva anymore. He leaves Rav Aharon to be the Rosh Yeshiva, and then he goes to Israel, and he's the Rosh Yeshiva of the Etz Chaim Yeshiva. He returns one time because they had the dedication of the new building of the Kletsk Yeshiva, but Rav Isher Zalman was in Israel. Why did he split paths with Rav Aharon? Because he had no real role. He was rabbi in Slutsk. And then when he left Slutsk and went to Kletsk, he wasn't a rabbi anymore. And Rav Aharon had really created this yeshiva when he moved from Slutsk. Rav Aharon took a group of his students and they went to Kletsk. And Rav Aharon was running the yeshiva. He was raising the money. Rav Isher Zalman really couldn't be a Rosh Yeshiva. He was elderly. To be a Rosh Yeshiva means to travel all over to raise money. The most he could do was give some shiurim. But he was always a great lover of Eretz Yisrael. Unlike Rav Aharon Cutler, Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer was always a great lover of Israel, a proto-Zionist. And when the opportunity came up for him to move to Eretz Yisrael, he immediately wanted to take it. And he went to... I don't think, Moshe, if you heard the previous talk, you didn't remember, where the story with the yeshiva student who Rav Aharon kicked him out of the Kletsk yeshiva because he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael to learn in Rav Kook's yeshiva. So what did the yeshiva student do? He went to live with Rav Isher Zalman, who supported him. They had a very different perspective when it came to Eretz Yisrael. But I don't know about you. I'm very impressed and really in awe of Rav Aharon that he had the possibility to leave, to go to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Isher Zalman is pressuring him. For all we know, his wife was pressuring him. And he says, I am not leaving without the yeshiva students. It was only when he felt there was no, when the Soviets moved in and without getting to America, there wouldn't be any way to help them. But did he leave? Okay, no final questions. Okay, and that, one more question. I see Moshe's writing in. Okay, Freilichim Purim. That's what Moshe is saying. So we have two more weeks. What I can say, well, I'll speak to this about Rabbi Kelman because I was hoping to finish Rav Aharon. I think I might need 3 weeks. I'll speak to Rabbi Kelman and we'll see. If not, we'll continue it for a future time. But yes, thank you all. Have a very good Purim. I saw a new minhag. Let me end with this. A new minhag this Shabbos in my shul. Not only did we do Parsha Zachar, as you all did, a few people stood up for it, so then everyone else looked at them and said, well, if they're standing up, we all should stand, and wouldn't you know it, within 30 seconds, the whole shul is standing for Parsha Zachar. I think now, next year, this will now be the new practice, everyone stands for Parsha Zachar. Now, this never happened when I was young. These are new practices. The Baal Koreh, Chabad, when they read Parsha Zachar, they repeat one word. They say, Timcheh es Zecher, Zecher Amalek. The general minhag used to be, and I know this, and I've said this many times, because my bar mitzvah parsha was Kiseitse, so I always pay attention when they read this. The general minhag always was, you read Timcheh es Zecher Amalek, Timcheh es Zecher Amalek. However, the Baal Koreh in our shul, and I've seen this happen other places, he does the whole, the pasuk. Now, I asked him why he does that, and he's a big student of Rabbi Soloveitchik. He said that was the Rav's idea. The Rav thought you should do the whole pasuk. But I said to him that if you're not here and I get up and do it, everyone's going to assume if I just do the old way, Timcheh Zecher, Timcheh Zecher, they're going to assume I'm doing something wrong, and they're going to make me repeat the whole pasuk. And he laughed because it's true. In most shuls, it seems that they do the whole pasuk. Now they make you do the whole pasuk, and if you don't do the whole pasuk, They'll tell you you have to do the whole Pasuk, but this is only a minhag of 20 years. I remember very vividly. In fact, I learned this. I learned Parsha Zachar. And we never repeated the whole Pasuk. So there's an example of a new minhag. And the women hearing it is also fairly new minhag. It's probably about maybe 100 years or so, but none of the Rishonim held that women need to hear it. So it's a good thing. And Rav Avad Yosef says that there's no problem in taking the Torah out to hear them. But anyone who says that the Minhagim or the Orthodoxy doesn't change, these are real changes here. That to tell the women they have to come. In Europe, the women were not told they have to come to hear Parsha Zachar. Rabbi Kelman says that everyone in your show also stood. Okay, it's a problem, I think, because as we spoke about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, it's a problem standing up for the Aseres HaDibros. So I guess it wouldn't be a problem, though, for the Parsha Zachar, because you stand from the beginning of the Aliyah. But why stand for it? Well, who says, why would you stand for Parsha Zachar? What makes it sort of a Parsha that you stand for? We know why you stand for the Aseres HaDibros. You stand for Az Yashir, I guess. But I don't know, but it seems that that's the general minhag now. Okay, everyone, yes, have a Freilich HaPurim, enjoyable time, and we'll pick up next week.